This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and we call the show Main Street because these microphones are our virtual Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. The real ones out there where people are crossing the street and saying hello to their friends and neighbors and sharing what's on their minds, we love those as well, and we invite you to our discussion today with Alona Peterson. She is the founder of the New York Kammermusiker Ensemble, and they're coming back to North Dakota for the 11th annual Winds of Change Tour. Thanks for being with us, Alona.
Thank you very much.
Tell us a little bit about the group. How did it get started? Because it goes back almost 50 years now.
Well, it didn't start as a double reed group. It started more with strings and winds. And then we went to octets, wind octets, and the regular wind quintets. There are many groups like this. And I decided that just the double reeds, oboes, oboe d'amore, English horn, bassoon, and contrabassoon would be a unique sound. And we've been doing a lot of music research for this group, finding a lot of music and putting it to our instruments. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
And you're a North Dakota native, too, so you're coming back for Sitting to Mai, huh?
I am from North Dakota. I graduated from Grand Forks Central, and we're going to be playing in Grand Forks for the first time this year.
And Alona Peterson, it is Sitting to Mai, and you are going to be doing some Norwegian-themed performances or Scandinavian-themed performances.
Since Norway seems to be the country this year, and today is, by the way, Norwegian Constitution Day, where they're trying to keep their cultural heritage going, we are going to be doing, in every city that we're playing in and every concert, we'll do some Norwegian music, some will be Norwegian dances, some will be compositions that we're receiving from Norway. Not all of them will work on our instruments, but we're working on this right now and we're excited about it.
And we should mention that Saturday, June 24th, is the 40th Scandinavian Hjemkomst Festival at the Hjemkomst Center in Moorhead, and you'll be performing there. So
yes,
that sort of kicks off the tour. Let's talk about the music itself. Let's get a sample to begin with. This is a Courant by Samuel Scheidt, the composer. Let's get a sense of what the New York Kammermusiker Ensemble sounds like. That is a very bright sound, and it's a beautiful sound as well. Can you describe to our listeners how you put together sort of the different instruments that are playing in this ensemble to make what is a room-filling sound?
Well, it doesn't always work. We work very hard at choosing who plays which instrument. You know, two oboes, two English horns, two bassoons, contra. Once in a while, what we're adding now is everyone's playing English horns or everyone's playing bassoons. every sound is different. That's what's so great. It's very close to the human voice singing, and we try to imitate what choral groups do, but with our wind instruments.
I was seeing bows and curtsies as I was listening to that music. It sounds almost like you're in a court.
Well, it's a dance.
How were the ensemble members selected for the tour?
Oh, for this tour? Well, there's a fight every year. Everybody now wants to come to North Dakota. And, of course, we can't afford all the air tickets, and we're still working on. We're trying to bring as many as we can this year that would like. We have one of our bassoonists, one of our original double reed performers of our group from Germany coming. We're hoping that Joe from Mexico can come back. He's trying to get out of his orchestra. He asked me, is there a direct flight from Bogota to Fargo?
Not that I know of.
And various musicians, when we're in New York, it's easy because it's a whole turnover of musicians constantly coming through there. Everyone seems to want to come to play with us because it's more fun than playing in their major orchestras where they have a conductor. We don't have a conductor. They get to say something in our group.
Now, the group has been here coming here for now 11 years this year. How are these tours funded?
Oh, this is difficult. I think I started about 12 months ago, and it's getting harder and harder every year. I wanted to make a small point that the federal grants that come to the national from the National Endowment of the Arts, from humanities, and for public broadcasting, when that money comes out to North Dakota, that's very, very little in the budget. But it has a larger impact than it does in New York City, where we have like funding for the Metropolitan Opera, the Philharmonic. The other thing that I've been working on is trying to involve the communities, and I've had a lot of nice help. I'm glad that they co-sponsor us in kind or any way they can, because then they become a part of our group. And they feel important, we feel important, and that makes our group want to come back here every year.
Well, you've got a lot of sponsors and in-kind sponsors and Arts Council sponsors. You mentioned the North Dakota Council on the Arts and the Council on the Humanities, Arts Midwest, Three Rivers Arts Council, and the Grand Forks County Historical Society. So you've got, you know, those names behind you. That helps.
It does help, but we're still hoping that this can continue. I think that everyone has to let their politicians know that this is a very important aspect in the future of North Dakota.
How do you pick the places where you perform?
That's not easy either. Sometimes they come to me or request. For Ellendale, for instance, I had so many requests from South Dakota residents that came last year and another year that I felt we cannot leave Ellendale out, you know, because we not only bring North Dakota residents, but we also cover South Dakota there.
So that Ellendale has been on the tour a couple of times?
I think this is our third or fourth trip there.
And there's a famous animal at the Ellendale Opera House,
yes.
Isn't there?
Frank, the cat.
Why is Frank so famous and important?
I guess Frank is a good-looking tomcat. I see him on Facebook all the time, and it seems that everybody knows Frank. His master, or maybe Frank is the master, is Ken, who organizes the Opera House down there for the concerts.
So you do anything special when you go to a place like the Ellendale Opera House?
We are going to have new compositions this year, one for Ellendale. This is our Brazilian composer. He wrote a piece for Frank the Cat. And Bjorn, of course, is going to have to do the narration on this one.
Bjorn is your son.
Yes. Uh-huh. And then we're going back to the zoo in Wahpeton. For Tall.
Tall is an orangutan, right?
Yes. And he has a composition coming.
And he's going to perform with the Kammer Musiker.
Right.
And you've done this before, right?
We did it last year. We didn't know if he wanted to do it. We just came and we played. And he definitely played and he definitely wants to do it. I hear he's working an hour a day now for a couple of weeks practicing his recorder. And I'm anxious to hear and see what's happening out there.
And so how do you do this? You sit outside the cage and he performs?
Yes, very close outside. And if he wants to come over, which he does, he follows us. And we actually worked with him before the concert last year. Two of us went and we let him get to know who we were, what our instruments sounded like. And we went just on a chance that maybe he would just not even come to that end of the cage. He did. He sat there for almost 3 hours listening to us. And then the day we played, we came in and 8 or 9 musicians right next to him and we started to play. He listened for a few minutes. Then he went over to the trainer and motioned that he wanted his recorder and he started playing.
Oh, well, let's give our listeners another sample of what Tall likes about Kammer Musiker Ensemble. And this is the suite from the Fairy Queen finale by Henry Purcell. Well, as you listen to that, imagine a big orange hairy beast playing the recorder along with the Kammer Musiker Ensemble.
That's right. or we'll be playing along with him.
Now, not only do you do these unique performances at the Chihinkapa Zoo or at the Ellendale Opera House, but you also make appearances at senior homes around
the
region.
Well, we try to cover everybody on these tours. Every town we go to, we try to do a mini concert for the seniors. which are very, I mean, we do this in New York, too. We work once a month with early signs, Alzheimer's, and other groups, Jewish homes that are a little more lively than Norwegian homes, say uninhibited. But the home in Valley Memorial in Grand Forks, I hear they have 100 Norwegians there, so they're going to be happy.
Yes, they will be.
And then we also do master classes. We try to cover, and this is for anyone. We're pretty good at deciding who gets, you know, what they need. And I find this very, very important that, because I come from North Dakota and I was always dying to hear outside groups. But what outside groups do is bring in a different culture, a different way of thinking. And in our group, here we have musicians from Europe, South America, and U.S. So they get a lot of different information. And we've been through the routines with auditions and orchestra, so we can – and also new music that probably we have more music than any group in the world right now.
Why is there so much new music?
We are doing major research constantly in every way we can, and finding a lot of the old music that works very well on the winds. And probably because it, you know, the oboe-like instrument is the most, it's the closest to the human voice that you come.
And when we were listening to those selections, I mean, it does sound like it would be something you'd play at court, like I mentioned earlier, but you're actually pushing the envelope a bit because your son Bjorn is going to be doing rap with the Kammer Musiker Ensemble.
Let's hope Tal likes rap. That's all I got to say.
Well, I don't think of rap with oboes and bassoons. That's an interesting idea.
Yes, we have a couple of very creative composers. I have to say, one year we had to play for the Frankfurt Radio, and they wanted a list of what they could choose from, and they chose this Brazilian composer's piece, and it was just for the mouthpieces of our instruments, not the instrument at all. And I thought, oh my gosh, but we did it.
Now, there is this educational component. You mentioned the master classes, but when you are doing these concerts, there's a fair amount of history that's tied with these pieces.
Right. We're very, very good at explaining and trying to make everybody understand the music, the instruments, whatever. History, but I got one history buff with us that always is relating everything to history here in North Dakota. He's not from North Dakota.
Now, when people perform, you know, if I sing and I'm in the shower, I sound pretty darn good. What kind of environments does the Kammermusiker Ensemble prefer? I mean, what is an opera house a great place for you? Where do you sound really good?
We sound good in good acoustics. That's what it is. When we went to Sydney, Australia, we played in the large Sydney Opera House.
And
I thought, oh, my gosh, there were only four of us. But it was fabulous. The stage was bigger than the Metropolitan Opera stage. I couldn't believe it. It was really something. But because the acoustics are good, that makes this this sound come out.
Now, every year you come out here for the Winds of Change tour and you do some new stuff. And
yes.
And you encourage people to listen to and get into chamber music. What's the future of this?
You know, it's a sad thing because we traveled all over the world. U.S. has the least tradition in classical music and chamber music of any place in the world. We're just hoping that we can get this tradition in before, you know, before we lose the funding for people to come out, you know, to different areas of the country. It's a big, it's a job. And I think with us, we try to mix everything so that people say, oh, I don't like classical music. They like it when they leave our concerts.
When you're back in New York, is the ensemble performing regularly or?
Regularly. And when we're not, we do a lot of what we do is read the music that we're putting through the computers and putting on different instruments and let the we have like a couple of places we go monthly and audiences just come to listen and then they vote which way they like it, you know, which instrumentation. So that keeps us going constantly.
Well, you start in Moorhead on Saturday, June 24th, and you're in Fargo Monday, June 26th on the Valley News Live's North Dakota Today program in the morning. Then you're in Wahpeton on Tuesday for a public mini concert, and then that performance with Tall, and you're at the St. Catharines Living Center as well. Then back to Fargo at Etche Gallery, where you've got a ticketed performance. And
well,
let's talk a bit
ticketed,
about that.
But our co-sponsors, we're honoring all our co-sponsors, and we want them all to come and bring their friends and enjoy it.
And Etche Gallery is a nice compact space right downtown on Broadway. Mm-hmm. Then in Ellendale, Thursday, June 29th at the historic Ellendale Opera House, and in Grand Forks, Saturday for a appearance at the Grand Forks County Historical Society, then a concert at 11, a master class, and a public concert in the late afternoon as well. You've got a busy schedule in
June. It's busy, yes.
Okay. Let's get another sample of what the New York Kammermusiker Ensemble sounds like. This is the suite from The Water Music, Air by Handel. As we were playing that, Ilona said, as we heard a piece of music there, that's me.
I started the piece.
Very good. So this sound, is it this very rich sound, this double reed sound, how far back does it go?
Oh, it goes way, way back. The Renaissance composers, well, actually, there used to be what they called the Schaum bands on the street corners in Europe. Schaum, we have them here in New York. They're about 400 years old. They're the ancestors of the oboes and bassoons. They're loud, so they're good for street playing. Then in the Baroque time, it went to Baroque instruments and then on to our modern instruments. So it's been a whole cycle of double reeds.
And Ilona Peterson, a North Dakota girl, comes back every summer for the Winds of Change tour with the New York Kammermusiker Ensemble. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
It kicks off in late June, and it runs for about a week all across North Dakota, so we hope you can take it in if it comes to your town. Ilona Peterson is the founder of the New York Kammermusiker Ensemble. Tom Ezern is next.
Today's programming is made possible in part by Maria and Eric Overn, celebrating their 20th wedding anniversary today.
Hey, do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-6377. We want to hear from you.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. And Tom Ezern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. He creates the Plainsfolk Essay, stories that tell us about the history of the place where we live. And today, his essay is titled, Mr. Abel's Round Barn.
Gerald, my guide to the ghost town of Bernstad and its vicinity in Logan County, figured he could get us there, but not directly. He knew about the Robert Abel Round Barn, but the problem was, in this wet hydrological cycle we've seen since the early 1990s, many of the section roads of Gerald's youth have been inundated. After inquiring around, we managed to get to the site and only had to open one gate. Round barns are an uncommon but valued element in the North Dakota historic landscape. When I say round, I'm using a generic term which also comprises octagonal buildings, but the Abel Round Barn is truly round. The historical and architectural literature on round barns is all over the place, by which I mean there is no clear environmental or cultural association with the building type. Some barn types are found in certain types of countryside. It's hard to have bank barns, for instance, if you don't have hills. Other barn types, such as German house barns, are associated with particular ethnic origins. Round barns have more individualistic origins, popping up as single instances or clusters in various places, born in the fertile mind of some local innovator who may or may not have read literature about them in other places. Many of the round barns are associated with particular feeding systems. Some have haylofts. Quite commonly, they are built around upright silos, which dispensed feed into troughs and stalls in the barn, so that both workers and livestock were sheltered in winter. Mr. Abel built this round barn in 1942, which was late for such a building type. Moreover, it incorporates no infrastructure for feeding, having neither loft nor silo. It is a barn in the technical sense that it was built to shelter livestock, but in function, it's really just a cattle shed. So we are brought back to consider the builder, Robert Abel. What was he thinking in 1942? His origins are a little bit obscure. According to census data, he was born in 1879 or 1880 in Missouri or in North Dakota. He had an eighth-grade education and owned his own farm. He and wife Alvina had a lot of children, at least nine by my count. In 1986, the State Historical Society of North Dakota did research on round barns and successfully nominated a group of them to the National Register of Historic Places. At that time, an Abel son, Bert, recalled that it cost $800 to build the barn. The nomination says the barn is 60 feet in diameter, but in fact I found it to be about 45. The barn is all milled lumber, except for the six cedar posts holding up the roof in the center. The center posts are tied together under the roof by a circle of inch boards warped and nailed together four thick. The round foundation is poured concrete. The walls are supported by heavy vertical studs. The siding is tongue and groove, warped and nailed horizontally onto the studs. There is one wide door facing south. I know there is a certain efficiency to round buildings, enclosing more space with less material, but this job could have been done a lot more easily as a simple rectangular shed. It is hard to come up with reasons for building the barn as it is, except impractical ones, aesthetics, and pride in workmanship. In mid-20th century, those values were going out of style. But I departed the site, marveling at their expression, in a building still in service on a working farm in Logan County.
That's Tom Ezern. Coming up on Main Street, Ashley Thornburg went on location for a book signing by Danielle Nadler, author of Without a Trace, The Life of Sierra Phantom. It's the intriguing story of a man whose personal tragedies led him to live in the wilderness of the Sierra Nevada mountains for 50 years. So that's coming up on Main Street. First, though, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Minnesota Governor Mark Dayton says sincere differences remain between his position and that of the Republican-controlled legislature over the state budget. The DFL governor and GOP legislative leaders are facing a Monday midnight deadline to finish the 2017 session. After a day of negotiations, Dayton said an on-time finish to the legislative session is still feasible, but it will depend on the leaders focusing squarely on the numbers and less on policy shifts.
It's really going to be their decision. If they want to finish on time next Monday, then let's focus on the budget, a real ID, a couple of the things, bonding bill, get it resolved. If they don't, if they're going to insist on bringing all the policy into these discussions, there's just no way.
There is a tentative agreement on agriculture, and the two sides say they're getting closer on a tax bill. Senator Heidi Heitkamp is continuing to push for continued federal funding for the FM diversion project. Heitkamp says she talked with leaders of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and with Office of Management and Budget Director Mick Mulvaney about the project. Heitkamp says two deadlines loom, the release of the 2018 budget as well as the release of the 2017 core work plan.
It is critically important that we be present in both of those if we're going to continue momentum on the FM diversion. And so we're pushing really hard, both folks at the Corps and folks at OMB, and I think those results are going to pay off.
Heitkamp says the Trump administration wants to cut the core project by 16%. She says that could put North Dakota flood control projects at risk. Heitkamp's comments were supplied by her office. And as summer months bring severe weather and the potential for storm damage, the Better Business Bureau of Minnesota and North Dakota is cautioning consumers about choosing reliable contractors for repairs. Dan Hendrickson is a spokesman for the BBB. He says when an area experiences widespread storm damage, it can attract less than honest contractors.
Well, I think anyone that shows up at your doorstep and hits you with the high-pressure sell, I think good businesses can definitely come to your door. They should have a solicitor's license if they need one from your city. They should be willing to sit down with you and go over your damage carefully, give you a fully laid out estimate in writing, and give you also time to get other estimates. Anyone who comes to your door and says, well, this is my best price, take it or leave it right now, I think right there that's a warning sign you might want to move on and find someone else.
Hendrickson says the BBB offers several tips to consumers to help them navigate the storm recovery and finding reputable contractors, such as documenting all damage with photographs and sending them to your insurance company, waiting to get repairs until your insurance company assesses the damage, and shopping around to compare rates. Hendrickson says it's also a good rule of thumb to never pay in advance and never use cash. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. We enjoy modern conveniences like running hot and cold water, electricity, shelter, and easy access to food, but that life is not for everyone. John Glover grew up an orphan, joined the military to fight in World War II, and then took to the Sierra Nevada wilderness where he lived alone for 50 years. South Dakota native Danielle Nadler is a journalist who graduated from MSU Moorhead, and she's worked across the country. She was captivated by Glover's story, so much so that she wrote a book about him, Without a Trace, The Life of Sierra Phantom. Main Street's Ashley Thornburg caught up with Nadler at a weekend book signing at Junkyard Brewery in Moorhead.
Danielle, thank you so much for joining me today.
For sure. Thank you so much for having me.
How's it feel to be back in Moorhead? You are a 2005 graduate of MSUM, a degree in mass communications. Went on to get several jobs, win pretty prestigious awards in multiple states. Now you've come back on a book tour.
Yeah. Oh, very fun. Usually when I come back, it's Christmas time and it's just hanging out with family. So it's really fun to be back for something that, to be honest, I never imagined that I would do. So it's so cool. I feel like I said yes to an opportunity that would have been just as easy to say no to. So it's fun to sort of maybe reap some of those rewards and then to share this really cool experience with other friends and family and former professors that we're running into, which has been a ton of fun. So.
Yeah, I hear that a lot from authors who, you know, I grew up thinking people who wrote books knew from a young age that they were going to write books, and then that's all they did. And then I've just met more and more who just say, I kind of stumbled into this. How did you first learn about this story?
No, that's a great way to put that. Ever since I was 15, I wanted to be a journalist, and specifically a newspaper reporter is what always kind of was my drive. And that's mostly what I've always done. I worked for newspapers, and from MSUM, I worked for newspapers at Rochester Post Bulletin, and then California in Las Vegas, and now near Washington, D.C. in Virginia. And everything is going peachy keen, and I enjoy it. But then 6 years ago, my friend called from California, and he was hiking near Bishop, kind of the Mammoth area, and he said, I just met a guy who has this incredible life story, and you have to write a book about him. And I told him, Craig, that's really nice, but I don't write books, and that's not the kind of writing that I do, and I just can't imagine ever getting the time to do something like that. But he kind of made me promise to at least call him and just give him 10 minutes. And within a couple of moments, this 80-year-old man on the other end of the country and I agreed to get down his story. And kind of the gist of it that really captured my attention, and I think is what's capturing other people's attention, is he lived about 5 decades in the Sierra Nevada mountains, off the land, off the wild. And that's a really cool story in itself. But then as he became more comfortable with me, he opened up and talked about his childhood and what drove him out to the wild and drove him to this kind of lonely lifestyle. And he was an orphan during the Great Depression. He fought in World War II, and a lot of those early life experiences is what kind of prompted him to abandon a lot of what he knew and a lot of civilization. And when I met him, he was kind of finally warming up to civilization again. And that's where the book opens, and really where our story opens, of him being like, maybe people aren't so bad. So, yeah.
I like that he says that as, what, 80-something? Maybe people aren't so bad.
Exactly. And that, I think, becomes a lot of the story, is him warming up and really, toward the end of his life, finding great friends and realizing that sharing some of the toughest part of his life, it became, he was able to then leave a mark on the world and leave behind a legacy that would have otherwise been lost. So.
Give me one sort of outrageous story from his life.
In his day-to-day, trying to live and survive in the wild, he was a very thin man, like 125 pounds or less. So he was trying to get enough fat in his diet, and he fished a lot. He did a lot of trout, or he'd catch a lot of trout, and he said the trout do not have a lot of fat. So in order to get enough fat in his diet, he'd also hunt, and then he'd melt down 25 pounds from each deer, or he said he'd get about 25 pounds of fat from a deer, and he'd melt down the fat and put a dollop in everything he ate, including his coffee. So that was kind of, I felt like that was a good example of like, okay, this is his day-to-day. That was his day-to-day life. Maybe another one is when he first decided to go out to the wild and up into the mountains to live, he almost got killed by an avalanche. So this avalanche pushed him off a ledge. So he's in his early 20s at this point, pushes him off this ledge, and he lost his pack, lost everything he had, food, water, and he's at the bottom of this terrain, and he had to scrape his way up, and he said he was just bloody, fingernails are gone, fingernails lost. He gets to the top, walks to a town that's 9 miles away, gets a milkshake, and then calls the sheriff, and the sheriff helped him get supplies again, and he went straight back out there. So I asked him, why in the world, this was your first introduction to this wilderness life, why would you go back out again? And he said, because he was an orphan, and he said, I felt like I wanted freedom my entire life, and I'd finally had a taste of it, and I wasn't ready to give that up yet. So his stories are like, okay, you know, just such cool stuff. So
The two of you, you and the Sierra Phantom, have very different backgrounds. You're about 5 decades apart in age, more or less. You were living in major cities, Las Vegas and outside of Washington, D.C. He's living a hermit lifestyle in the mountains. I understand from a journalist's perspective why you're drawn to him. It's an incredible story. What is it, do you think, that he saw in you that made him open up?
A lot of the things I was asking him, I almost felt guilty to say, hey, I'm in my 20s and I'm bugging this old man when he should be relaxing and retiring. And I'm asking him to go back to some of the worst moments of his life, like war or his childhood. But gradually, I think we became friends, and it was really like an unlikely friendship. So I think he realized that I really just cared for him and had a heart for getting down his story. And I wanted him to leave something behind. And it's almost like it was proof of his existence, because he didn't have any family. He never married. He never had kids. And I think he kind of realized, if I don't share this now, it might be lost. I think it also helped that we weren't in person, because it was almost like a counseling, maybe for him, a bit of a counseling session, because he could just open up and share, and I would hit record on my phone and just listen. And I think that meant a lot to him, that I wasn't chiming in with advice or anything like that. I was just kind of nodding along, and I just felt, at one point he told me, I always wanted to get my story down. I always thought about writing a book, but I'm not good with the commas and the periods. And I told him, dude, just tell me your story. I'll put the commas and the periods in the right place. And I feel like that's what we did. And it just meant so much that I got to tell his story. It means the world.
The commas and the periods, what was the editing process like for you? It's very different than writing for a newspaper.
Yes, it is. That took a few years. I actually rewrote several versions of it. At first it was in first person, and then it's now in third person. This is my first book, and it took a long time for me to find my voice in this type of writing, in this long form writing. And for editing, well, I did hire a professional copy editor, because as an editor myself, I really appreciate, not having any errors and correct grammar and everything. But also my mom's an excellent writer, and my little sister just loves reading. So I would send them stuff, and they'd send it back, and they'd say, chapter 8's a little boring, or this or that. And I'd say, okay, we're deleting half of chapter 8, or we'll tighten this up. But it was a few years long process, and partly because I have a full-time job as a reporter and editor, so that was a big chunk of it. But yeah, it was a definite, it did not, maybe some authors it's this way, but for me, I did not sit down and it just came out beautifully. Not at all. It was a lot of different versions and a lot of deleting and then adding things back in until I think we got it to a point where where I was happy with it and ready to share it.
It's that great quote, if I had more time, I'd have written a shorter letter.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. Yeah, I ended up deleting probably four chapters, and then tons of other notes that, I would try to write for a half hour to an hour every morning, and it seemed so small. But otherwise, if I wasn't doing that, I noticed that I would shelf it for like 2 months, and then it was hard to get back into it. So I actually read a Stephen King book on writing, and that was his suggestion, was every morning just do a little something, and that helped a ton. So it's encouraging when you hear someone like Stephen King, like, okay, it doesn't just comes, you sit down and all of a sudden it's good to go, comes out beautifully the first time. So that's encouraging. I think I'm also not alone in some of that struggle to get to the right end product.
Is there anything you cut from the book that still somehow you wish would have made it in there?
Actually, yeah. As the book goes on, I become a little bit of a character in the book, reluctantly, but I think that ended up having to happen. And I don't want to give any spoilers, but yeah, that ended up kind of having to happen. And for six months, I quit newspapers and worked on Capitol Hill. And I think there's a scene where my editor said, I've never met anyone who loves journalism more and is good at it, and I can't believe you're leaving. And I cut that because it was so personal to me, but I now kind of wish it was in there, because not that it would be about me, but it really shows how meaningful stories are to me and well-told stories. And then to go take a job in politics. Anyway, I was only there 6 months. It was not my jam at all. And I think that's why, because very quickly I returned to realizing, man, the power of telling the stories of neighborhood heroes means so much more to me than making sure a politician's message is just so. And I just realized I was not passionate about that, but instead about stories that matter and make a difference.
Do you think you'd want to write another book?
Yes, I think so. It's almost like a curse now, a lovely, like, awesome curse. So I think a year ago I would have said no way when I was in the thick of writing this last book. But now a couple of people have approached me with stories. So a couple of people have approached me with their life stories. And interesting enough, it's also men in their now these guys are in their mid-60s. And each of them, I've said, let's do it. So we'll just have to, they need to be patient, because I'm not for sure what the timeline will look like. But it's exciting. There's so many amazing true stories out there that I think we do that with journalism also, of course. But some of these long-form books, I think if for a couple of these guys, I feel like if I don't get them down, their stories may not be told, and I'd love to be a part of that storytelling process. So,
you know, one thing that we go through when we go through getting this degree, mass communications, is, you know, not getting too close to your source, of course. And that's, I mean, especially if you're a Capitol Hill reporter, you don't want to be chummy with a senator and then sit around and try to cover the senator, conflict of interest. Did you ever feel like you were crossing an ethical line?
That's funny you say that. So that becomes a big, or that is a part of the story. Because, yes, I think, for example, there's a scene where one year I sent Sierra Phantom a Christmas card. And I said, whoa, I've never sent a source a Christmas card. And it was kind of a small example of, we've now crossed, he's no longer a source. He's become a friend and someone I really value and respect. And there was a couple other, so there's about six rules that I actually kind of lay out of journalism that I broke. And one of them is sharing the writing beforehand. I sent him a good portion of the book that he read, and just several other things that I think he almost taught me, Sierra Phantom almost taught me to be okay with going outside those boundaries. Not obviously at my job as a newspaper reporter, but with our relationship. And he kind of was like, you know what, there's more adventure on the other side of these things without these rules. So that was really cool. I don't think it would have turned out quite like it did if I didn't cross some of those boundaries.
I'm a big believer in it's better to beg pardon than permission.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Was it hard to go back to newspaper writing after this experience?
No, I love that too. And I think honestly it's helped me. I feel like I'm better at describing a scene, even if it's a school board meeting. I feel like it's stretched my creative writing side a little bit more. So I don't know if any of our readers in Loudoun County have recognized that, but I think I've really worked hard and paid more attention to the writing, and of course not just the reporting and the investigating, which I've always cared about too. So I think it's made me a better reporter outside of just being more stressed and like less sleep. I think it's made me a better reporter actually.
Writing somebody's personal story, do you have to fact check it the way that you would fact check a story on Capitol Hill?
I felt that is one ethical kind of rule of journalism that I didn't break, because I think it was really important to make sure, because it's a wild, his story is wild, and if it wasn't true, it'd be really, I don't know, it'd be really sad, and to be honest, not worth telling. So I had to find a lot of people who especially knew him when he was in his 30s and 40s, and they confirmed a lot of his story to me. And then also I went out there and did a lot of research, and there's a few things that I make clear in the book that I wasn't able to, you know, small details that I wasn't able to completely confirm. But generally, like, he did live this way, he lived in the wilderness, and I interviewed people who, almost like Christ's resurrection, you know, we interviewed people who saw it. In this, I interviewed people who knew Sierra Phantom at that time. And yeah, so that was tricky. That was tricky to research all that from across the country. And I did end up going out there, and that helped too. But that was a ton of work as well, to not just believe everything that he's telling me, but to write it down and trust him to an extent, but then also fact check and follow up with other sources.
You started a newspaper.
Yeah.
Weird time in journalism to be starting a newspaper.
So I work in Northern Virginia, Loudoun County, Virginia, and there are two main newspapers in that county. And I worked for one called Leesburg Today, and it had been there for almost 30 years. And then one day we showed up on Election Day. It was in November 2015. And Election Day in journalism is like the Super Bowl. So I had reporters out all over the county, and we had, in the middle, they called us all to a meeting, and they said, our competition has bought us out, and they're closing us tomorrow. So we still had to get through Election Day and report it. And it was a really intense day, but within the next 24 hours, community members from all over Northern Virginia called and said, you guys, we trust you as a non-biased news source, and we don't want you to go away. What do you need to start a new newspaper? So 3 days later, we started Loud Now. And we didn't miss a day of publication because both papers there print weekly, and we're daily online and all that, of course. But anyway, and it's been an amazing experience. I think the community almost values community journalism more because they realize what could have been lost. And it's weird. I've never felt, especially in journalism, the wind at our back. Financially, that it's tough, and you know, we're not raking in anything, but we're really careful at keeping low overhead and just letting the community know that we value them, that we're here to stay, and then we're finding that they are in turn valuing us and are wanting to support us so that they do have a local news source that they can trust. And it's been a really amazing year and a half, so thanks for asking about that.
What's next for Danielle?
Well, I am starting to research a couple of more books, and back to work Monday at Loud and Now at the newspaper, so that'll be busy. And then, I don't know what some of the book writing and just the author side of me, where that will go, but I feel like I've caught a bug that I can't. I'm like excited for the next one already, which is so cool and encouraging when it's something that I never thought I'd even do. So we'll have to see what that looks like with also track, because I'm managing editor of this newspaper. So we have a good team, but we'll have to see what that looks like and how both can happen. And it might just be, well, you know, this book, to be honest, it took me about 6 years, the full process. So it might just be, every 5 years or so I put out a book, which that'd be kind of fun too. So, yeah.
Thank you, Danielle. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been awesome.
You can find a copy of Without a Trace, The Life of Sierra Phantom at Barnes & Noble or online at Amazon.com. Dakota Datebook is next.
At Prairie Public, we are seeking stories of teachers using public radio material. One of our listeners told us that she uses Dakota Datebook every day in her class, and it made us wonder about other possible uses. News stories to discuss current events, music programs that explore a certain style. If you have a story as a teacher or a student or a parent, let us know so we can tell others about it. Call 800-359-6900 or send a note to info@prairiepublic.org.
There was a hard knock at the door in the middle of the night. Three men in the military uniform, the KGB major, handed me a warrant for my arrest.
Join us for stories of Soviet interrogations, community builders, and Arctic explorers. That's next time on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Thursday at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 17th. Happy Sutton Demai. For those of you who don't know what that is, an old article in the Hansborough News explains that May 17th is the anniversary of the rise of modern Norway among the nations as an independent, self-governing kingdom. The year the article was written was 1914, the year of Norway's Jubilee, and it stated that the 100-year celebration was of peculiar interest to about 2.25 million people living in Norway, and about two-thirds as many of their kinsmen in foreign countries, for the most part in the United States and Canada. During the years leading up to the centennial, Norwegians constructed a number of special buildings for a grand exposition. It was announced, the Cathedral of Trondheim, the most magnificent building in all of Scandinavia, will be the scene of elaborate ceremonies, and that Eidsvold, the birthplace of the Constitution, will be the great Mecca for those who visit southern Norway. A quaint, almost homely building was dedicated to Det Udfledet Norge, or the emigrated Norway. It housed exhibits from Norwegians living mainly in North Dakota and Minnesota. Many Norwegians who had moved to America and Canada were expected to come back for the festivities, and according to the Hansborough News, Norway wanted them back to stay. In a puffed-up bit of writing, the news reported that people back in the old country had found that Norwegians who had moved to America were much more enterprising than those who had never ventured abroad. The story continued in a pure flight of fancy. Norway has large areas of tillable soil that have never been put under the plow. The greatest drawing card to be aimed at the prospective settlers will be a list of farm and garden land for sale in all parts of Norway. The government has printed 20,000 copies of this list as a starter. If the story was accurate, Norway was certainly in denial about the economic hardships that had caused so many of its people to move to America in the first place. The largest Sitten de Mai celebration outside of Norway that year took place at the Minneapolis Fairgrounds. 2 months later, a state delegation traveled to Christiania, Norway, where they presented a statue of Abraham Lincoln as a gift from the people of North Dakota. The unveiling took place at Frogner Park on July 4th. Senator J.G. Gunderson of Aneta read a poem by James Foley, the writer of the lyrics for the North Dakota hymn. The chorus of Norwegian Singers of America sang the Star-Spangled Banner, and addresses were given by Governor Louis Hanna of Fargo, Editor P.O. Strami of Grand Forks, and Smith Stimmel, the Fargo man who served as Lincoln's bodyguard. The Luther College Concert Band played several numbers, including My Country, Tis of Thee, and Governor Hanna's daughter, Dorothy, unveiled the statue. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Mary Helm. I'm Meryl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein briefs the Senate over President Trump's firing of FBI Director James Comey. One of Comey's deputies wants to know more about the motive.
I think it would be really damning if we hear from Rod Rosenstein that I knew I was going to be the fall guy. I feel horribly about it, but I'm going to take this hit for some political end.
The future of the FBI, plus Iran elects a president, on the next Morning Edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Thursday on Main Street, our resident film critic, Matt O'Lean, will review King Arthur, Legend of the Sword. Chef Tim Rosendahl of Rosie's Bistro will join us with this week's food topic, and Ashley Thornburg and I will have our What's Happening calendar of events. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.